My guest John Burns is in Baghdad. He's a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He's won Pulitzer Prizes for his coverage of the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan and for his reporting from Bosnia. We called him earlier today in his hotel room. As we record this, it's morning in the east coast of the United States. It's afternoon where you are in Baghdad. What has your day been like? What have you done? How close have you been to the bombing today?
Well, I'll start with our night. That's to say, our Wednesday night into Thursday. We were aware from statements that had been made in Qatar, the Central Command Headquarters for the War, and in Washington, that attention was going to turn to certain telecommunications buildings in Baghdad, and in addition to the Republican Guard formations southwest of the city, which are facing the 3rd Infantry Division as it advances towards Baghdad. And in the course of the night, there were a series of massive explosions, easily the biggest single explosions that we have heard since the war began a week ago. One of them in particular, from across the river, was so powerful you could have imagined it was an earthquake. The 20-story Palestine hotel in which I'm staying shook, and I imagined for a moment that it might actually fall to the ground. It wasn't until past dawn that we were able to discover what the target of that strike had been. It turned out to be the principal telecommunications or telephone headquarters for southern Baghdad. That's to say, the telephone system that serves the part of the city where much of the government and many of Saddam Hussein's palaces are centered. And the intriguing thing about that strike, and I have just returned from seeing it for the first time, the result of it, this building is a massive block of a building rising to perhaps 12 or 15 stories, and it sits immediately adjacent to what is known as the Saddam Tower. It's a 700-foot tower of a kind that the citizens of Seattle, for example, would be very familiar. It's a needle with a restaurant about two-thirds of the way up. What the United States military planners did was they managed to put a bomb, a massive bomb, right on the roof of the telecommunications center without so much as damaging in any way other than a few broken windows, the tower, the Saddam Tower, which stands perhaps, I'm guessing here, but no more than about 50 or 60 yards across open ground from it. Once again, they've obviously decided to save what can be saved here. They're going after military targets.
How close have any of the bombs come to you?
Well, this afternoon, they came very close. The Ministry of Information building, another vast, gargantuan structure that sits in the same government quarter of the city, we have been warned repeatedly by the Pentagon that we should not go there, that it's a potential military target. Our judgment has been that since the ministry insists on holding news conferences there and the Pentagon can see us coming in and going out, that they will not destroy it, at least during the day. Today, that turned out to be not the best judgment because we were gathered for a news conference in mid-afternoon for one of the ministers. And just as we were assembled in the briefing room, two huge explosions struck. We don't know exactly what they struck, but they were close enough that everybody abandoned the building immediately. And it was the first time that I've seen the press corps here with a sense of real alarm. Otherwise, we have seen many of these strikes from our hotel balconies overnight. And you can occasionally glimpse the cruise missiles. You certainly hear them. One of them came past the other night, and I would guess, just a guess, from the sound of it, it was a little bit like being on the edge of a military airfield when a low-flying supersonic jet goes by. I would think it was passing within about 500 yards of where I was standing.
What's your sense of popular opinion now in Baghdad? Is the United States being seen as liberators or occupiers?
You know, the honest answer to that is that nobody can tell in the sense that Mr. Gallup could, were this another kind of society altogether, exactly where the balance of public opinion lies. What we do know is that there are sharp divides here. It's no surprise to say that there are large numbers of loyalists of Saddam Hussein who still at this hour hold a monopoly of physical power. How numerous they are, we don't know, but they certainly are in the tens of thousands. There are others at the other end of the spectrum who we have heard from in the last years only by whispers, who very much want another kind of Iraq, a free Iraq, an Iraq free from fear and free from terror. One might surmise that they are very numerous indeed from the various indications that we get here. In the middle ground, there are people who are concerned above all for their own safety. And that is to say, these are people who, even if they would wish for a new Iraq, do not wish to see their families put at the kind of hazard that they think they will be by an American siege of Baghdad and an attempt to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say it certainly sounds like it's not a clear-cut issue that the Iraqis see the United States and British as liberators.
Well, you know something? We will know that only at the end of this. But I think you have to remember that the penalty for expression, free expression of opinion here, is extremely severe. Within the last hour, an Iraqi known to me and a person of considerable personal fortitude, frightened by the sense that he might be considered to be less than completely loyal, was reduced in a moment to the most pitiable state of fear and shaking. He said, "They will shoot me, they will shoot me." I don't know if that's literally true, but I do know that in 30 years of reporting on hard places and hard times, I have never been in a country where people are so afraid. Trying to peer beyond this to find out what people really think is extremely difficult.
You know, you just mentioned the person who you know well, who was, you know, reduced to quivering because he was afraid he would be shot by the Saddam Hussein regime because of something he said or did. You've, I think, implied in your reporting that even your minders, the people assigned by the Saddam Hussein government to mind you as a journalist, if you do the wrong thing by those standards, they can get in trouble and be terribly punished. So that puts you in a funny position, doesn't it?
You know, I don't. There's always a danger. I'm very, very aware of the risk of journalists making themselves the story. I, as a British passport holder and a correspondent for the New York Times, have protections here that most of the 24 million people of Iraq do not have. That being said, I do not remember a time in my 30 years now as a foreign correspondent that is anywhere near as complicated as this is. And one of the complications is the one you just mentioned, which is that whatever we calculate, however we make the calculus for our own safety in chasing stories, we have to always keep in mind that the hazards are not ones we take for ourselves alone. That we have drivers and minders, or as they prefer to call themselves, guides, who are very much more exposed than we are. I have been in the execution chamber at the Abu Ghraib prison, which is the heart of the Iraqi Gulag, about 20 kilometers west of where I am now sitting. And I have seen the butcher's hooks row upon row in the ceiling. So I know where the story ends here for people who have been judged to be disloyal or plotters or in some way who have crossed the regime.
Can you see signs of preparation within Baghdad for urban war, for a conflict between the coalition forces and the Iraqi troops?
Well, in a sense, that's a very easy question to answer. Saddam Hussein's government has said all along that if war came, they would fight it with all means at their disposal. We have already seen the power of which they dispose. They have, if they haven't given the United States and the United Kingdom a biff on the nose or a black eye in the last week, they have certainly shown that they have a powerful resistance, I think considerably greater than the Pentagon expected, and to be honest, most of us who have reported here in the last years expected, because of our own estimate of, if you will, the exhaustion of the Iraqi people after 30 years under this government. Baghdad is the core of this whole issue. It's a city of 5 million people. It sits on the flat desert. It's about 30 to 35 miles across. It's a huge city. Taking this city and toppling its government will be an enormous, complicated exercise. And we know how the defense of the city will be conducted already, because the Iraqi leadership has told us it will be done just as the defense of Basra and other cities has been conducted, with mainly irregular forces. We know that those forces have a tremendous degree of political commitment. They will fight to the end, and they are dispersed around the city. One can see that just moving around Baghdad.
But what do you see? Where do you see them?
Well, you see them in pickup trucks everywhere. It intrigued me. I begin to realize now why it was that in the latter months of last year, enormous numbers of pickup trucks were being imported to Iraq. And I crossed that border west of here to Jordan quite a number of times. And one evening I saw 600 of these Japanese pickup trucks of a kind that would be familiar to Americans. 600 of them sitting on transporters inbound to Iraq. I now realize what that was all about. As early as last October, Saddam Hussein knew how he was going to fight this war. And the pickup truck is the basic combat vehicle of the irregulars. They can carry 10 or 12 people in them. They can mount a machine gun in the back. They can carry bazookas, rocket-propelled grenades, and, of course, Kalashnikovs and pistols. And they are mean customers. These are not people that you would want to cross. And there are large numbers of them in Baghdad. In effect, they are the shock troops, the guerrillas of this regime. The main army and the Republican Guard, of course, are deployed out in a sort of perimeter defense of the city. One can only imagine how complex an issue it will be once the United States Armed Forces get to the crux of the matter, which is the capture or elimination of the president of Iraq. He has many, many options. He's told us that again and again. And I thought at one point, as many of us did, this might be a short war. I think that we would be wise to assume that the siege of Baghdad could last weeks and weeks, 2 months, possibly more, rather than the week or two or three that some of us thought a week ago it was like to be.
Would you stay for the siege to cover it, or would you go to a safer place?
You know, I think that I can say, and it doesn't distinguish me from my colleagues here, that every single one of us will stay if we are allowed to. It may seem strange to people watching this war from afar on television, but we are a happy band of brothers and sisters here. This is what they pay us money to do. The life of a foreign correspondent is an adventure. It's endlessly intriguing. It calls on every resource that we have, and to be here at the heart of this drama is extremely engaging, and I would not wish to be anywhere else. I actually think, odd as it might seem to some of your listeners, I think every morning when I wake up, how lucky I am to be here and how many people in my profession and at my newspaper would happily take my place.
Well, here you are, and I mean, you are risking your life to cover this war, but here you are in a hotel in Baghdad where I'm not sure if you're seen by the people at the hotel as the friend or the enemy or just purely the customer. What is your relationship with the people who work at the hotel?
You know, you've asked exactly the right question, and it may be that the answer to this will tell your listeners more than anything else I could say about the likely outcome of this. I am here as a representative of the New York Times, one of the principal newspapers in the United States of America, which has declared war on Iraq. I carry a British passport, which is the combatant ally of the United States. Everywhere I go in Baghdad, I am greeted with enormous amiability and enthusiasm, and I can think of no exception to that. If I tell you that I was yesterday at the site of a bombing attack, which the Iraqis blamed on the United States military, in which 17 Iraqis died and 45 were injured, and that in the, I don't know if there is such a phrase, I think it's something we'll have to invent if it doesn't exist, the mud rain at Baghdad, there was this sandstorm which had darkened the city for days on end, but it began to rain, and the rain falls as spattering mud, and so we were surrounded by these quite ghastly, satanic scene of blasted workshops and homes and burned out carbonized cars and your listeners will forgive me, but body parts and pools of blood and so forth. And the people who gathered there in that spattering mud rain were coming up to me and to John Lee Anderson of The New Yorker, who I tend to spend a great deal of time with, and asking from which countries we came. And as we answered respectively, England, Britain, the United States, we had our hands taken, vigorous handshakes, broad smiles. You are welcome, you are welcome. Now, this may be simply that the people of Iraq, who are very, very intelligent people, are capable of making the sort of distinction between a government and a people that any civilized people would make. Or it could be that encoded in that reaction is something much, much larger. My own inclination is to think that, as my late sainted mother used to say, it does not mean nothing.
Well, John Burns, I wish you safety. Thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for the reporting that you're doing.
Thank you very much.
John Burns speaking to us from Baghdad in an interview recorded earlier today. Burns is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.